Welcome to WOW 2007, the podcast. You are about to listen to Dr. Chris Johnson. So, exactly what does a 21st century learner look like?
I will come back to this slide at the end if anybody doesn't get this URL down. But it will, it has all of the slides. If you go to the resources page, there's a link on presentations and you'll see the WOW conference there. And so just click on that and it will take you to all the slides in this presentation. I want to start out by kind of thanking Bernadine for doing part of my presentation because I'm going to be talking about 21st century learners in ways similar that she was. But I think what I'll do, hopefully what I'll do is give you a little bit more background information and things to think about to take back to your schools. I will ask you at any point, please go ahead and pipe up, ask questions. One of the issues though is I've gotten older, and it's all those rock concerts I shouldn't have gone to. I'm getting deaf, so make sure that you speak up, please. I'm a little bit hard of hearing. At least that's the story I tell my wife. So, my name is Chris Johnson. I've spent a number of years at the University of Arizona working with College of Humanities and a couple of other colleges looking at using technology. And through all of that, kind of as Bernadine was saying, I found that what I needed to do was shift away from looking at the technology to looking at the learners and looking at the students and looking at the skills that they needed. And so I've started kind of focusing on, so what do we know about 21st century learners and what do we know about their learning modalities and their preferences, and then how can we start to kind of play with that and move forward. So my purpose today, wait a minute. You know, this is actually kind of a left brain sort of way to look at this. So let's look at maybe perhaps a more 21st century way to look at my goals for the presentation. So my goal is to provide you with all of this rich knowledge, but my guess is one of the things that you're going to remember when you leave this presentation is the elephant on the trampoline, right? But think about that when you're designing things for your students in terms of what are other modalities that you need to tap in order to be meaningful for them. So the message today is kind of the three C's. First, we're going to look at context of 21st century learning. Then we'll look at some of the characteristics of a learner, and from that point on, bringing creativity to teaching, and kind of all the things that creativity brings to a classroom in terms of imagination and playfulness and joy, as Bernadine was saying. So one of the contexts, and she mentioned this, there's a book out there. If you ever have to do anything with a government official, read The World is Flat to be able to talk to them. This has become their Bible. Actually, my recommendation is go to audible.com and buy the audio book for it and then listen to it. Because this sucker's big. But one of the basic things that Friedman talks about is the flattening of the economy. This idea that anything that can be automated will be, and anything that can be turned into routine instructions and done by a human will be done elsewhere. Because the tools that we have, the internet, software that allows people to collaborate is moving work across the world. And we as a nation, I think this is the main thing we need to be aware of. So as Friedman says, you kind of have to constantly upgrade what you're doing. There will be plenty of jobs out there for people. One of the fears of outsourcing is it will reduce jobs. The major thing about outsourcing is not that it's going to reduce jobs, it's going to significantly change jobs. And it will significantly change high-end versus low-end paying jobs. The high-end paying jobs are going to be for creativity and imagination. The low-end jobs will be repetitive skills. So, another piece of the context is technology. So if you would, how has technology changed in your lifetime? And looking around the room, there's going to be, I'm going to pick on you guys, some more significant change than for some of the other part of the audience here. So how have these three things changed? How have computers, the internet, and the speed of accessing information? Yes?
When I was a teenager, the phone was attached to the wall with a cord, and I sat at the kitchen table with my feet on the table until one of my parents saw me, and then
okay, so phone on the wall with a dial.
Exactly.
Okay. When's the last time you told a 14-year-old to go dial a number?
Yeah.
Huh? They don't have dials.
Okay. Computers were mainframes.
Computers were mainframes?
Yeah.
How did you interact with them?
Key cards.
There are people here that will hold up as a badge of honor that I carried around my 500 card COBOL program that did like buy things. And I took it to this huge computer, I put it in, and then I came back the next day to get the answer. Okay, other things.
My high school computer class was
the code.
Okay,
was coding.
So I had someone else.
I used to use typewriters.
Yes.
Okay. How about you guys?
With a carriage.
And I'm picking on you because you're a little bit younger than some of the other of the crowd. So
I didn't have access to email in college.
Okay.
So to me, it was like that was the new thing. And now I have a younger sister who's in college. And, I mean, she's grown up with email.
So she's grown up with email.
I just remember being so excited to be able to talk to someone and
okay.
my friends at another college in another state on email.
Yep. So we've got email. We have computers. What have the computers done? If we look at a mainframe to?
Personal.
They become personal. They become smaller. They become something that you can carry around. Okay? A little laptop back there. I've got my laptop here.
Coming even smaller. Okay. The iPhone that's coming out.
The iPhone?
It's almost a full computer because it's able to type full Word type documents and do all your work on the iPhone. So it's becoming this big.
Yep. Anyone seen these things? The trios?
Yeah.
Okay, so I can access the web and I can do email on this. Not as quickly as I'd like to, but so yeah, they've gotten smaller. What else has happened to them?
The
flash drives.
Yeah, the flash drives.
Those of us who remember floppies,
and
can now put like 1,000 of those onto one of the flash drives.
And somebody, my wife, is in this volunteer place where they have this old computer. She says, "How do we get a file onto a disk?" And I'm thinking, "How am I going to do this?"
Yeah.
It's portable.
They're portable.
Used to be if you wanted to look something up, you had to go somewhere where there was a computer and talk
okay.
to it, and just take it with you or you have it in your pocket.
So access to information.
I remember doing one thing at a time.
Okay. That's true, running one program at a time. So, they've gotten faster, they've gotten smaller. The information that we have accessed, how many of you ever had to try to download a large picture on a 1200 baud modem? Okay, now I get frustrated when I can't download the two-hour movie in a reasonable time. So these things are all happening in the technology, in the context of the technology. And there are six trends that are kind of driving this. that if you go out and you read technology magazines, talks about these six trends. Now I'm going to talk about four of them. Probably the two that are going to have the biggest impact on the economy are actually the last two, biotechnology and nanotechnology. The nanotechnology is what Bernadine was talking about in terms of the wearable computing, or a computer on a piece of paper that you can print. But these others right now are having kind of an impact on education. Anyone ever heard of Moore's Law? What does Moore's Law say?
Computing power doubles every...
Computer power doubles every some period of time, and something else happens. And what happens is, Moore's Law says that the computing power of a computer doubles every 18 months. It's about the same speed as the amount of information that's out there. But there's another significant thing that it does. The cost is halved. So every 18 months, the computer that you just bought is now out of date and costs half what you bought it for. Which you could look at as being really frustrating as an investment. But you can also look at it as a force that says, we can, in a while, stop worrying about providing this stuff. The hardware. We still kind of need to be doing it for access because it's not at a price that every child can have access to it. So for another few years, we're going to have to worry about providing for access. But eventually, and do a survey of this, it does depend on socioeconomic things. Ask your students how many of them have a cell phone. Now, if you teach kindergarten, that's going to be a smaller percentage. Yes, I've seen kindergartners with their own cell phones. Ask a high school class or a college class, pretty much all of them have cell phones. And what Moore's Law says is that eventually everybody will have a cell phone that has as much processing power as my laptop, and it's going to cost what a current cell phone costs, which ranges from $200 to $300 to, all right, sign up for a two-year plan, you get it for free. So Moore's Law says that these things become commodities. The law of the photon says that that pipe that's out there, that's the internet, that brings stuff to you, also, I keep on forgetting Moore's Law, so it triples every 12 months, or every year the capacity of the internet triples. Anyone heard of Internet 2? Internet 2 is the next version of the internet. It's like 10 times faster, and it's not going to stop there. So that two-hour movie that at home on my broadband, it now takes a half an hour to download, I'll be able to play it real time in about 4 or 5 years. That's going to significantly change access to things, to information. So if we think we have a lot of information that we can access now as we go up on our web browsers, wait until we can download all of this stuff really, really fast, really, really cheap, and bring it to something that I can be out on the top of a mountain and pick up because it's about the size of a cell phone. And you all know that most cell phones are designed by Japanese 20-somethings that have really small fingers and good eyesight. So there's some issues about these technologies that are going to be really, really interesting as they get smaller, cheaper, faster. Now the internet revolution goes a little bit with some of the things that Bernadine was saying. But there are 3 million new web pages every day that are created. And I should say, this is web pages, it's websites. There's 3 million new websites every day. 10 billion instant messages are sent. 19 billion email messages, and 12 billion of them are spam. I get about half of those, I think. And 80% of the sites that will exist a year from now do not exist today. 80% of the websites that exist today, or excuse me, will exist in a year, don't exist today. So we're going to have this vast amount of information just increasing. And Bernadine did, I'm going to steal that activity. That was a wonderful activity showing you how this information doubles. Another way to look at it, more data has been produced in the last 50 years than in the previous, how many? 100? 1,000? We got everything. Any other bids? If you consider 5,000 years as everything, our recorded history, yeah. More data has been produced in the last 50 years than in the last 5,000. Technical information doubles how fast. So we talked about, pardon the expression, the crap out there. So the crap is doubling every 18 months. Technical information, which you can consider as valid information, how fast is that doubling? Want to take a guess?
3 months.
3 months? Every 2 weeks. More than 3,000 books are published every day. Now here we go back to the crap factor, that the controls of publishing have been taken off, because anyone in this room can publish a book. There are websites you can go out to. You say, here's my book in PDF. I want to make X amount of money off of it on each sale. They will advertise it. You can send people to the website and say, buy my book. Susan will go to that website and say, okay, there's Chris's book. I want to buy it. They will print it and ship it to her. They'll print it, bind it, and ship it to her that day. So anybody can become a book publisher. And as we look at encouraging students to become producers of knowledge as opposed to simply receptors of knowledge, that has some interesting ramifications. So how does this impact our students? A lot of what I'm going to talk about comes from the work of the Partnership for 21st Century Skills. And also from a book called Educating the Net Gen, done by Educause. So one of the things is, when I grew up, the expectation was that I would hold one or two jobs within a career in my lifetime. And it actually expanded a little bit for me. It was like maybe three or four jobs. But the expectation now is the students will have between 10 and 15 jobs in up to three different careers. So not only will they change jobs 15 times, they will change what the field that they're doing it, their career, at least three times. So if we look at job skills, a lot of people will say that American schools are broken. I think they're doing fine. They're doing fine in preparing 19th century students. Because their focus is, mastery of one field. And this is no condemnation of anything that you might be doing as a classroom teacher. This is the system of school. It's the way it's structured. It's our expectations. It's the way that we've grown up. Anybody know the time to innovation, from innovation to adoption in a business? A new product comes out as an innovation and it's adopted in business? 2 months. Time for adoption in education? 50 years. 50 years. So we've got some pressures here. So the pressure is on our teaching model of moving from subject matter mastery, which is what we test, moving to the integration of some 21st century skills. I'll show you some examples or talk about those briefly. And subject matter mastery. So we don't do away with the subject matter mastery. There's certain things you need to know about certain disciplines, and we still need to teach those. But we need to add to that certain other skills. And it also means we need to move our assessment model. And this is probably the hardest. Because for most part, the average citizen in the U.S. does not know the difference between accountability and assessment. They equate the two. This gentleman by the name of Frank Peharis has a wonderful quote. Education is the only profession that has an internship that starts at age 5. Think about that. Every parent you're working with, every school board member that you're working with, every business leader that you're working with knows what teaching is because they went through it. They were the recipient of it. And so their decisions about what teaching should look like, especially in terms of assessment, was formed 20 to 30 to 40 to 50 years ago. That's something we have to work on. Because what we're finding business wants is, yeah, they do need some basic concepts, or excuse me, facts, but the important things are the overarching concepts and processes of the discipline. The habits of mind, of being a scientist rather than knowing some scientific information, of being a mathematician as opposed to knowing basic math facts, the habits of mind of being a writer or a producer of communication as opposed to grammar skills. Now, grammar skills are still important, and if you've ever text messages with any of these kids, you know that grammar skills are kind of going the wayside. But there are other skills that are also important. So what do you all think are the most important skills for the 21st century? This is a similar question to what Berna Jean, but I want to kind of get a little bit more out of you guys. What do you think are our most important skills for the 21st century?
Empathy.
Problem solving. Adaptability.
Collaboration. Creativity. Interpersonal skills.
Intrapersonal skills.
So knowledge of myself, knowledge of working with others.
I think just a basic grounding in real knowledge of human development in there.
Okay.
You know what makes people tick.
Okay. And I would classify that as the interpersonal, but I like that definition a little bit better of knowing what people, how people tick, how to interact with people, especially people of diverse cultures. Any other skills?
Lifelong learners.
Okay. And I'm going to... Yes, I thoroughly agree with that, but I'm going to pick on that one for just a little bit, because what do we mean by that? Because if you've watched a kid learning World of Warcraft, you've seen a lifelong learner. But for me, in terms of lifelong learning, how does that equate to jobs and skills as opposed to entertainment? Okay, I would challenge you all to think a little bit differently. We say that kids, you know, they're in school, they don't learn, but if you watch them outside of school, they're learners. Now, their learning strategies may not be what we want them to be, and they may not be what they need to be to go into the workforce. So I'd like to qualify, we all say lifelong learning, but I think we need to equate that to lifelong learning in the workplace. Okay? So, I'd like to point out some skills that have been identified in a work by the Conference Board, the Corporate Voices for Working Families, the Partnership for 21st Century Skills, and the Society for Human Resource Management have said that there is a set of basic skills and applied skills that we need for 21st century learners. Here are the basic skills. Recognize them. This is NCLB as it should be. All of these skills are identified from No Child Left Behind. It's all of the skills that we're supposed to be teaching and supposed to be testing. And so what these folks are saying is, with these skills and what we're going to do next, they're of equal weight. And there are some people that would say that these next skills are first among equals. And I would point out, this is the challenge of education, is that right now we're focusing in here. We have limited time to do that. We have limited resources to do that. Our heart is over here. Our heart as educators is on the right side. These are all the skills. Whenever you ask a teacher what they want to teach, it's the right side. Whenever you ask them what they are teaching and then squeezing in a little bit of the right side, it's the left side. And it is because we teach what we test. And so I want to kind of reiterate Berna Jean's getting an attitude. As an educator, I cannot go into a classroom. I feel ethically I can't go into a classroom and espouse my own political views. But as an educator, everywhere outside the classroom, I feel I have a responsibility to do that. So I try to agitate and to educate. I try to agitate fellow teachers and educate any person I run into. So my friends and relatives know what I'm going to talk about. But I think we have to start talking about, look at what's really important. Okay, go ahead and celebrate that Arizona's AIMS scores are rising. But remember what's behind that statement. That means that our 12th graders can graduate at a 10th grade level on a third of the curriculum that they're supposed to be learning. So is that something to be celebrating, or is that something that you as a public person need to be talking to those decision makers about? So that's the little political statement for today. But I feel firmly that as educators, we need to be advocating, and a large portion of advocating is educating people we know. I can tell you, I do not know any legislators. But I do know people who do know legislators. So I'm working on those folks. So just kind of keep that in mind as you think about, oh my God, there's no way I can teach all of that. You're absolutely right. But we need to start doing it. So we need to start thinking about education and teaching and learning a little bit differently within a 21st century context. Bernadine also mentioned a new book that's out, A Whole New Mind. Daniel Pink posits, and I agree with him, this just resonates with me, that if it's repetitive or can be programmed into a computer, it's going to go somewhere else. So if we really want to stay competitive, we need to work on the right sides of our brains. If you look at most of what we do in school, it's left brain activity. Left brain, logical, analytical, is important. This is another first among equals. But creativity, or as he puts it, he defines six different skills that are important. Design, story, symphony, empathy, we mentioned that. My favorite, play, and meaning. If you have the opportunity, watch a learning machine. They're called one-year-olds or two-year-olds, often before they get to school. Does anybody know what a child's first word generally is?
No.
No? Dad? Mom? There's another one that comes before that. Uh-oh. I tried something. I fell down. What's the first thing a child does when they fall down? Do they cry? The very first thing they do is look for an adult. If there's an adult and they're not bleeding, they get up and move on. If there's an adult, no matter what, they start crying. If they get up, they say, uh-oh, and they move on. How many times for your students do you allow them uh-oh moments? Do you celebrate uh-oh moments? We don't celebrate uh-oh moments in schools. We punish them. No. Eric, thank you for that answer. Thank you for playing. You're wrong, but, you know. And I've heard this coming out of the mouths of teachers. Not meaning it, but, you know, not, oh, that's a really creative answer. You know, and in your mind you're saying an absolutely stupid, but, you know, I have no idea how you got it. But thinking about ways that we can create uh-oh moments for students, that we can make learning fun. We beat the fun out of school. Bernadine showed us those pictures of joy. You don't have to go to a movie. Walk into a lot of classrooms and you'll see those faces. So I would encourage you as much as you can to start to look at other ways to introduce creativity and play, design, relationship organization. How many of you use concept maps? Okay. If you're not using concept maps, I'd suggest that you look into them. They're a very good way to graphically organize information. But remember, with concept maps, some students will take to them, some will not. And so often when we have a technology, we bring it into the class, and like we've assumed that every student learns well by lecturing, then every student must learn well if we do concept maps with them. So we need to start looking at these technologies to truly let us start to differentiate instruction. And a lot of these tools can let us do that. So, let's look at this group. It's a group, we're not quite sure what to call them. They've been called the millennials, the net generation. I happen to like digital natives because I'm a digital immigrant. Alan Kay has a wonderful quote, "Technology is technology only for those who were born before it was invented." Computers are a technology for me. They're not for students today. They've had them all their lives. The internet is not a technology. It's just a way of being. Instant messaging is not a technology. It's the way that I talk to my friends. But when we're talking about characteristics, it's kind of important to remember that we're talking about the average student. And here's the problem with that. The average student is a 6'2" Chinese girl by the name of Steve. I mean, if you look at average. The average student does not exist. So what we're talking about is trends. So I'll talk about some characteristics, and if you went out there and looked at students, you'll find some with these characteristics and some with not. But if you looked at that trend over time, you'll see more and more of them with these characteristics. And also more and more adults as we as digital natives become more familiar with these tools. So, what are some of the characteristics of your students? Yes?
Multitasking. Short attention span.
Yes?
Very visual.
Okay.
Interactive.
I'm sorry?
Interactive.
Not
very physical.
Okay, not very physical.
Okay.
We're really becoming couch potatoes.
Immature.
Okay. Okay, not afraid to share what they think, using often inappropriate... Okay.
Less respect for adults.
Okay. Whoops. Interestingly enough, the research shows that they actually do respect adults. And I have this perspective from working at a university. Really, really fascinating phenomena for me. We did a study of our cell phone usage, because they were doing some contracts, and we wanted to find out when our peak cell phone usage was on the U of A campus. Any guess when it is?
Break.
Sorry?
During class.
Not during class. In the break between. I think I heard break over here somewhere. The break between class. You'll go 50 minutes, and then boom. Because they all call their friends and their parents during over that period of time. Those of you who have kids who have cell phones, and especially what we're finding now is kids that have gone to college, you hear from them way more often than you ever did when they lived in your house. Okay. So they do kind of respect us, but in a kind of bizarre sort of way. Now, some other characteristics, this comes from educating the NetGen, is they are comfortable with receiving information really, really fast. Now, so this is often why they have short attention spans. If it's not coming at them quickly, then they lose interest. I don't know if this is good or bad. A lot of these characteristics, don't know whether they're good or bad or not. I think we just have to acknowledge that that's kind of their mode, and then look at ways that we might be able to take advantage of that other than have to react to it. They like to parallel process and multitask. The jury is still out as to whether they do it well. They're always connected. Anyone had this experience? My wife and I don't have kids, but we have kids that we borrow, which is a great, you can give them back. So we got a 14-year-old, excuse me, I keep on doing that, he's 16 now. 16-year-old, 14-year-old, and a 10-year-old. So the 16-year-old and the 14-year-old have gotten phones. They've gotten cell phones. I'm driving them to something. They're in the back seat and they're text messaging me. And it turns out they're text messaging each other about me. So they're back there laughing, and I don't know what they're talking about. I finally ask them, and then they let me know that they've been talking about something that I had said. Really bizarre concept for me. They are, believe it or not, inquisitive and resourceful. Possibly not in school, though. So again, if you look at them outside, if you look at what they do in order to learn how to play their games, they're very inquisitive and very resourceful. They prefer graphics rather than text. They prefer random access, so that quickness of information. And they function best when they're networked. So think about that. And they actually do want engaging learning experiences, but the key word here is engaging. Now, we equate this, especially in games, to fun. But if you ask them what makes it fun, it's intellectually challenging, whereas school is not. Think about the decisions that I have to make. There's a wonderful book by Mark Prensky, Don't Bother Me, Mom, I'm Learning. He's got an example of this student who goes into World of Warcraft, decides he wants to set up a business in order to achieve his goals. So he's got to hire people to go out and go on quests to get gold for him. He's got to hire people to make food for them, to make armor. Eventually he has to hire an accountant to manage all of this. And he's just had a really bad experience because he's got to figure out how to fire somebody. And as a fifth grader, he's never had to do that before. Think about it. So, it gives them some qualities. Interactivity, they use inductive reasoning, they parallel process. And it also, we have some concerns. That short attention span, except if you do watch them gaming and they play it for 3 hours, I'm not sure that that's an equation of short attention span. They do need more work on reflection. Not real good on that. Practice text literacy and source quality. Now, for source quality, Berna Jean kind of talked about this too, but I want to take you to my favorite website. This is www.dhmo.org. It talks about the dangers of dihydrogen monoxide. Did you all know about this compound, dihydrogen monoxide? It has been responsible for thousands of deaths, billions of dollars in damage. And for those of us that the chemistry may be coming back to us, dihydrogen, two hydrogens, oxide, oxygen, so two hydrogens, H2O. This is a website about the dangers of water. 86% of one of our natural sciences classes at the University of Arizona couldn't figure out that this was a bogus website. When asked why they thought it was valid, it has PayPal.
Well, and it's a .org.
And it's a .org.
It must be.
Okay. Yeah, we told them that you could trust .edus and .orgs, right? So working on source quality is going to be an ever-increasing issue. So they are products of their environments. I'm a boomer. I grew up on typewriters. My major mode of communication with someone that was not a telephone was writing letters and memos. Then we have Generation X that started to be the email generation. And we moved on to this net gen, which is the IM generation. So, I'm not going to hit this slide too much, but there's actually brain research that tells us that these stimuli that they've grown up with is actually wiring their brain differently. So, how many of you check your email once a day? Okay, once a day. How many of you check it once a day? Okay, how many of you check it more than once an hour? Okay. How many of you have your own blog? Okay. And how many of you have created a podcast? The two major, I'm leaving out IMing here, two of the major communication tools for students. Now, how many of you can understand this? Yes?
I think so.
The first sentence is the hardest.
The first sentence is the hardest. I can do the maybe too much information, but...
Have you seen this one?
They talk to you later, okay. Cool.
AWFK, away from keyboard. Yeah. This one, the couple of these I've only seen every once in a while. Well, actually, and I've also seen it as pretty awesome stuff. Or there's another S word at the end. This is our, as far as I know. Okay. The uh-oh, two O's, uh-oh. And this is the parents are nearby. You need to know P-A-N-B, P-A-N-B, parents are nearby, or T-A-S, or T-O-S, teacher over shoulder. It means that they're talking about something they don't want you to know about. Okay. So, what can you do to incorporate kind of this 21st century learning into your classroom? Now, this could be a 2 to 3 day workshop in itself. So, all I'm going to do is give you some references of materials that I use to kind of help me learn more about these students. So first is the top, kind of these two. If you don't read any other two books, I would read those two, and the nice thing is they're both free. At least I think How People Learn is free. I may have had to buy that one. But the How People Learn by the National Research Council, I think is a very, very critical read. And then remember, I'm going to go back to my first slide. That has a URL that has all of these URLs if I go too fast now. Learning more about 21st century skills. Yeah, I've got time for this. You need to be creative and open to change.
Sitter där, så där.
Okay, so for those of you who might be comfortable with your scrolls, you know, because, yeah, the scroll is easier to use than the book.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I work with teachers, and they're exactly like that. They keep the things back exactly the way he did.
Okay.
So, memorize the steps like that.
There's a gentleman by the name of Alan November that I'm kind of taking his mantra. If you ever want to use technology, find a 12-year-old. You know, don't worry about how it works. Just find a 12-year-old. But if you do want to learn more about the skills and about the technologies, Partnership for 21st Century Skills is a good place to start. A couple other things. I've also got Daniel Pink's book down here. Is a good read. Be aware of their tools. Okay. And especially the big five. YouTube, gaming, text messaging, iPods, and MySpace. The interesting thing for me about the big five, they're all things that we ban in school. So remember, they work best when they're networked, and we're going to take all that stuff away from them. Be aware of these tools in particular. And I kind of picked these tools to get started with because, for me, they're easy to use and they're free. But more importantly, they're what kids are using in their own lives. One way to learn more is to, ASTE is an affiliate of ISTE, and ISTE looks at a lot of these technologies. One way to learn more about what they're doing with their technologies is simply to ask them. Okay, they'll tell you. They're more than happy to tell you and show you how they work. And then re-examine your own views in terms of teaching and learning and what it truly means to be a 21st century learner. And here are some other places. Again, ASTE and ISTE are two good resources to go to kind of look at that. But then also, if you've ever seen Change Magazine, and also I've realized I don't have it up there, but Leading and Learning, which is the ISTE magazine. So, remember, we could all do that at one point in our lives. Well, the ladies can do it easier than the men. But so the takeaway here is this explosion of new technologies is changing the ways that students interact with school, with each other, and with their learning. It's going to happen whether we're there or not. We can't stop it. So the good news is it is possible for you to become closer to a digital native. You just kind of have to remain flexible in your thinking. So I'd like to leave you with three quotes. One is from Albert Einstein. Says, I never teach my students, I only attempt to provide them the conditions in which they can learn. I think that's going to become critical for teachers. We've all heard this one. And then this last one is sometimes you just have to take that jump and build your parachute on the way down. Okay? So as you go off today, it's that time for kind of questions and thoughts and reflections. Hopefully I've gotten some things going that perhaps will put a framework for the rest of the day and you're thinking about how you can utilize these technologies. So what I'm going to do now, do I have 5 minutes? I have that we end at 35. Okay, so I am about a minute over. So let me just go back to that first slide for you all and point out for anyone that came in a little bit late, this presentation is here. Okay, just look for the link for presentations on that page and then look for the WOW presentation. I will tell you that I've done this several times, so if you look at any of the other of the 21st century skill ones, it's pretty much going to be the same talk. I just vary it a little bit for my own interest. But there's also a link there that takes you to all of the links in the PowerPoint. The reason is that the way I had to put it up on the web, the links aren't active. So I've got them separately. That way you just don't have to write them down. I don't know if you like me, but I hate writing them down. So I will be around the rest of the day. I'm going to end up so that our next presenter can get ready. And we'll leave this up as long as we can. Otherwise, you can come up and ask me. Otherwise, if you have questions, comments, I'd be happy to sit down and talk with you. Available through lunch. Whatever. So thank you all very much.